From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. You've all seen the movie Network, right? It's a masterfully dark parody of network news. Surely at least you've seen the iconic moment in the film where the unhinged anchorman Howard Beale shouts on live television that I'm as mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore. Well, the film came out in 1976, and the New York Times reporter Dave Itzkoff says it arrived at a moment of national frustration, and it made itself the center of an argument about the emptiness of modern American life. Today in the program, Itzkoff is joining us to talk about his book, which is about the making of the film, which in an uncanny way really predicted the future of modern media. But it's also a story about its screenwriter, Paddy Chayefsky, who poured all of his angst and anguish into that film. Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. You can donate $10 right now by texting KUER to 85944. That's KUER to 85944. And thanks.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. If you've seen the classic 1976 film Network, you'd be forgiven for calling it a dark satire of the business of broadcast news. Paddy Chayefsky, who wrote the screenplay for the film, once insisted it wasn't really a satire, though he said different things about it. I wrote a realistic drama, he said. The industry satirizes itself. In his new book about the film, the New York Times reporter Dave Itzkoff points out Chayefsky lived and died in a world where there were three major networks, a time way before the internet, of course. But if you look at the media landscape today, he got it right, pretty much. Cable networks with a 24-hour news cycle, lots of pundits and elaborate graphics, a culture Itzkoff calls a metastasizing organism perpetually subdividing itself into smaller and narrower niches. In his new book, he says the people who dispense these versions of the news seem to take their direction from Chayefsky's iconic character, the unhinged news anchor Howard Beale. They emote, he says, and inveigh and instruct their audiences how to act and feel. Today in the program, we're talking with David Itzkoff about his book. You'll recognize the title if you know Howard Beale. It's called Mad as Hell, The Making of Network and the Fateful Vision of the Angriest Man in Movies. You can join us. 801-585-WEST is the number. 801-585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. David Itzkoff regularly writes about film, TV, music, theater, and popular culture as a reporter for the New York Times. He's joining us today from a studio in the office of the Times. And David Itzkoff, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Well, I want to start as you were starting to think about all of this, and if I get this right, it kind of began in 2011. You were invited by the New York Public Library to come look at the papers of Paddy Chayefsky.
That's right. The library now owns the papers really from the breadth of his career, but they anyone can request to see them. But they were offering to show me specifically some papers pertaining to Network, and not only things like drafts of the screenplay, which were very different and really sort of showed an evolving story and one that was started out in a very different way than what ended up on the screen. But also, correspondence that Chayefsky kept throughout the making of the movie, and things like, for example, before the movie started, he wrote to Paul Newman to see if he might be interested in playing the character of Howard Beale. Yeah. That didn't come to pass. But also things like, after the movie came out, Chayefsky writes these letters of apology to Walter Cronkite and to John Chancellor, who were, two of the three big, network news anchors of the day, basically for, if he had wronged them in any way or, presented a depiction of their business that offended them. And those were really interesting documents. I mean, from what I knew about Chayefsky and would learn about him, I mean, he was not a man who really apologized for anything. And, you know, the fact that he was saying he was sorry to these people in particular, you know, I mean, it really suggested a much bigger story about this movie than I had ever, you know, previously seen told. And, you know, we touched on it a bit in that original article, and then the book, you know, really let me dive into that. Yeah.
He seems – we'll talk about this later, actually, when we come to kind of the reaction to the film when it finally comes out. But it seems like Chayefsky is kind of ambivalent about the reaction. The whole mad as hell line, he felt really conflicted about. Figured that had been oversimplified.
Yeah, I mean, he's somebody who basically, you know, he spent his whole career kind of, you know, always believing that, you know, audiences didn't totally get his work or didn't get, you know, whatever messages he was trying to put forward in them. And, you know, whether or not that's true, I mean, he certainly believed it, and he comes to believe that particularly about Network, which is trying to take on, you know, so many different topics, and it does become, you know, popularized by that speech. And of course, even the title of my book kind of preserves that one phrase. Yeah. But to him, it was kind of a very gross oversimplification of, you know, all that he was trying to touch on with it.
It's interesting. It seems like for you, as you're going through all of these papers, it wasn't really the film, it seems, that made you think about, you know, the theme of this movie. You know, the idea that we keep coming to about, gosh, he really got all this stuff right. But it was the actual reviews, the tone of disbelief that you saw when you were reading that.
I think that was definitely part of it. I mean, the movie is – I mean, it's still thrilling and you know, this is a joy to watch. It's so kind of hilariously obscene in a way that contemporary movies are not.
Yeah.
And just even the idea of, you know, a guy, you know, getting a lot of money from not one but two different, you know, Hollywood studios to basically make fun of media and to tell, you know, media what a bad job it's doing.
Yeah.
I mean, there's something really subversive about that. But I think you're right that it's there was also a bigger story about, you know, a man who would really go to any lengths to, you know, to make sure that the story that he wanted to tell was told in the way that he wanted to tell it. And that's not the kind of power that many people get, particularly in Hollywood. And I think he also paid a very substantial cost for that. And it was, you know, I mean, Chayefsky died in 1981 at the age of 58, which is, you know, a very young age for a screenwriter. And you think about all the work that might still have been ahead of him, you know, that we'll just never get to see.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about Chayefsky. You describe him as this short Bronx-born Jew, didn't care much about passion. Fashion. He seemed disheveled a lot. Didn't care much about convention. He was mischievous. But also, I don't know if you would describe him – you don't describe him as a curmudgeon, but he certainly was cantankerous.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, certainly by later in his life, there were, you know, the list of things that annoyed him had certainly accumulated to a great degree. But yeah, I mean, he was so sort of deeply attuned, you know, not only to his own dissatisfactions, but I think, you know, I think he thought of himself as being a kind of receptacle for, you know, the indignities of his fellow man, and a lot of things really got under his skin, and made him a great writer. It gave him plenty of material to work with, but it also made him a challenging person. You know, certainly for his professional colleagues, even though they adored him, and you know, his family life, his home life was extremely difficult, and you know, I think that sort of reinforced you know, his desire to just plunge himself even further into his work.
Yeah. You write about the year 1949 for Chayefsky. It was a momentous year for him. I mean, he gets married. That's a big deal. But
right.
Also, this is when he sees the play Death of a Salesman by Arthur Miller.
Right. And that's a really transformative thing, you know, for all of drama that, you know, whether you're, you know, a playwright or even before TV had kind of fully, you know, come into being, just this idea that, you know, the lives of, you know, the American middle class and, you know, even the lower classes is, you know, those are just as, you know, worthy of dramatic depiction as, you know, the kings that you see in Shakespeare, that these lives, you know, contain multitudes also.
It's interesting, his dialogue. People always talked about how he absolutely nailed, you know, the middle class language, the common man. And he would sort of push back on this idea that somehow he had transcribed actual conversations and just put them down like that. I mean, that's how sort of spot on, I guess, his writing was in terms of his dialogue.
Yeah, well, I think that he, you know, at first this idea that, you know, I mean, it you know, you must have gotten it from a tape recorder. I mean, it, you know, and that was always meant in a complimentary way to him. And initially he embraced it. And then I think at a certain point he saw it as a kind of, you know, he started to take it in a derogatory way, that it was somehow denying, you know, any sort of creativity on his part, or that he's trying to imbue ideas and meaning in the language that he writes. And, you know, it's a sort of oversimplification of what he does. He actually wrote an op-ed for the New York Times about this, where he was really kind of embittered about this, you know, this idea of, you know, having, you know, surreptitiously recorded his, you know, his dialogue from his plays. And you know, that really sort of a weird thing to be annoyed about, that again, people are trying to pay you this compliment. Yeah. and you're you know, you take offense at it. But that's the kind of person he was.
He liked to spar with reporters, I guess, at least from time to time.
Yeah, well, I mean, and they like to spar with him,
right?
You know, you see the that there's a, you know, they're always picking on the fact that he is, you know, short and stocky. Mm. And, you know, he likes to eat. You know, it's kind of a mistake for him to always be doing his interviews, you know, in settings where food is being served. And, you know, and so I think he learns, you know, early on to kind of keep, you know, to keep the press at an arm's length. And, you know what I mean, to sort of, you know, to treat them as you know, these kinds of, you know, useful idiots.
Mm. What were the themes that he was interested in? Because you say his best known characters were people, and this is how you put it, who feared nothing as much as unfulfillment.
If you look particularly at the kinds of people who tended to be protagonists in his television plays, and even going forward in, you know, a lot of his movies, I mean, they're all kind of, you know, middle class, underclass. The classic example would be, you know, Marty, the title character from the TV play and the movie, who is a butcher and, you know, a guy who's in his mid-30s, you know, doesn't have a girlfriend and is sort of, you know, desperately lonely. And, you know, not the typical sort of subject of a drama, particularly in the 1950s. And this is, you know, a character that Chayefsky is able to completely, you know, imagine and flesh out. But, you know, you also see the recurring theme of, you know, people who are very wound up and, you know, not given the opportunity to express themselves. Mm-hmm. And then usually there's like one big moment in each of these plays or films where, you know, they're finally allowed to kind of, you know, cut loose, and they do so in these very, you know, explosive ways, it, you know, with language, but in a very, you know, very loud voices, and really just, you know, these kind of, you know, gigantic rants. And that also becomes a kind of hallmark of his writing.
He had this kind of one thing you talk about is that he felt, I don't know if he felt passionate, but he really wanted to get a message across in his writing. He wanted it to be received by audiences. He wanted, not that he had an agenda necessarily, although I think he seems to have had these important ideas he wanted to convey, but it seems like he wanted audiences to really get it.
Yeah, well, I think maybe it's a sense of, you know, social responsibility in that, you know, if you're given a platform where you can reach as many people as he could, particularly with television, that, I mean, you've got to use that, you know, judiciously, and you've got to, in his mind, use it to tell people about things that they should be aware of and concerned about. And there were, you know, particularly by, you know, later in his life, there were so many things that he was, you know, fearful or anxious about, that he felt it'd be sort of, you know, irresponsible or, you know, a dereliction of his, you know, role as a dramatist if he's not using his work to, you know, turn people on to all these issues.
He writes, obviously, he comes to have this kind of sentiment about, well, conflicted sentiment about television a little bit later. But there was a time when he had, as you put it in the book, hopes for the possibilities of television. I mean, he wrote for the Philco Goodyear Television Playhouse. And this was really great stuff, really important ideas. I mean, I can't imagine it today, but I mean, this was good television in that way.
Yeah, I mean, in a weird way, we do have the kind of equivalent of it now. If you sort of look at, I think a lot of what the pay cable and, yeah. and you know cable just you know even basic cable is doing more and more of in their scripted programming. But that's sort of what it was like in the kind of in what we now call the golden era or the golden age of TV. That I mean, the format was so undefined and so nebulous that you really could do anything. And so a lot of these authors were looking to the stage and to the legitimate theater and, you know, basically writing plays for TV. And this is before, you know, there weren't established formats of, you know, crime procedurals and, you know, family sitcoms and all, you know, all these very, you know, increasingly narrow and calcified categories. So, you know, there was something almost kind of, transient about them, or kind of ephemeral. These things, you know, you basically put the play up once, and there wasn't even really a high end means of preserving these things. That you know, these things exist now as kinescopes rather than like digital, perfect digital copies, because they were never really even thinking about like reruns. They were just we're going to do it once, and an audience will see it, and hopefully they respond to it. And there's something very very down and dirty about that in a really sort of exciting way that TV just doesn't operate anymore.
Well, this is where, as you said, he writes Marty, which becomes incredibly, well, I don't know if incredibly popular, but certainly received a lot of acclaim. I mean, this was his first Academy Award for screenwriting with Marty, and it's a TV script first.
Right.
And
what's certainly the influence, not just the success of it as a sort of dramatic work, but as something that gets the movie industry to pay more attention to TV and to say, there is content here that we could adapt and turn into movies. And instead of sort of treating TV as this, competitive industry, maybe there's some kind of, there's some kind of synergy here, or there's a way for us to exploit this to our advantage. And that's a turning point for both of those businesses, but certainly on the road to network, it's a very crucial moment as well.
Yeah, and it's interesting because the success of Marty, you say, is, here you've got a simple black and white film, no action to speak of, just this simple, lovely, heartfelt story, this, blue collar, this butcher, all taking place, as you say, in a marketplace of these extravagant Technicolor movies. And the fact that a film like that was successful seemed pretty hopeful, at least at the moment,
Yeah. I mean, think about that as, these movies also got their due acclaim, but think of that as the era of, Ben-Hur and the Ten Commandments, and this, this is sort of the little film that could, and really has a kind of profound influence for its time, and people really feeling like if a movie like that can succeed, then all kinds of drama are possible in movies, and all kinds of stories can be told.
Let me get a sense. Of when was it then that Chayefsky really first comes up with this idea that becomes network? Because he has this, you mentioned in the book, he starts this screenplay. It was about the TV business sort of generally. He has all these different kinds of characters, producers and executives. And there's that Howard Beale sort of character here too, a mentally unstable newsacre. But he wasn't exactly sure how they were supposed to all kind of fit together. I want to have you read a section of this book, because this is sort of the early days before network becomes network. But he has all these themes that are sort of going around in his mind. You want to set this up for us, or do you want to just...
Sure. Yeah. So this is now, now we're fast forwarding to the mid-70s, and he's already even won a second Academy Award for The Hospital, which is obviously set in a hospital. It's also a kind of social satire with lots of characters, a kind of proto network. But the years, the years surrounding its creation and the years that follow, for him, he kind of feels are fruitless, because his work is just not, he's getting paid for it, but it's not getting produced, and the TV shows that he's pitching are not getting on the air. And so now he's kind of toying around with this idea of a script about TV, but he doesn't quite know what to make of it yet. So take, for example, the screenplay that he had started researching a few months earlier. Having cast his gaze on the television business that had provided the springboard for his career, He had drawn up a roster of characters to populate the world of a fictional broadcasting company. Producers, executives, underlings, corporate tycoons, political radicals, and a mentally unstable news anchor named Howard Beale. But Chayefsky could not determine how they fit together. Were they allegorical figures in a larger narrative about power and decadence, or were they just a bunch of grotesque caricatures? What did any of them have to do with the love story he was trying to thread through the script, and was that too conventional even to belong there? Across the top of a piece of paper he had torn from a notebook, Chayefsky wrote in jagged capital letters, nearly impaled by an aggressive underline, "The show lacks a point of view." Then in a gentler, pleading cursive handwriting, he filled both sides of that page with his unflinching self-analysis of the project, which he believed was drifting into chaos. I guess what bothers me is that the picture seems to have no ultimate statement beyond the idea that a network would kill for ratings, he wrote. Most crucially, he wondered, what was he even trying to say in this screenplay? Were there identifiable sides to this argument, and whose side was he on? Because if he couldn't answer that, what was he creating, if not more fuel for his pyre of curtailed efforts and unsatisfied aspirations? "We are making some kind of statement about American society," he wrote, "and its lack of clarity is what's bothering me. Even more, I'm not taking a stand. I'm not for anything or anyone. If we give Howard a speech at the end of the show, what would he say?" Sometime later, on a piece of the blank yellow paper he more commonly used for his writing, Chayefsky started to answer this question by sketching out a few handwritten phrases. "I want you people to get mad. You don't have to organize or vote for reformers. You just have to get mad."
I love that part of the book where we see the early days before, you know, we're imagining Howard Beale now, of course, and it's iconic. But in these days, it's so interesting the way he's working it out. He's not exactly sure what the core idea is. He has this general idea of anger, maybe. It's a general idea of what he wants to get at. But it's great because we're seeing that early, before he nails anything down.
Yeah, what's kind of extraordinary, there are a lot of things about it that are extraordinary to me, but one thing that blew me away was that, you know, as he writes, and, you know, the script goes through a lot of iterations over several months, I mean, he's not sharing these pages around with other people. He's not going to other screenwriters or to studio executives or even to his producing partner to say, hey, what do you think of this so far? Like, I mean, this is all very internal for him, and this is, you know, this is sort of how he edits himself, and he kind of knows what's best for him. And it when a script is done in his mind, you know, then he will deliver it to his studio and to his producing partner and say, okay, let's start making this movie. And even then, he's not really going to accept a lot of notes on his screenplay. All the editing is happening previously, and it's all just basically happening in his brain.
David Scoff is with us. He's a culture reporter for the New York Times. His new book is called Mad as Hell, The Making of Network and the Fateful Vision of the Angriest Man in Movies. You can join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are talking about the movie Network, the film from 1976, produced way before cable news programs or the internet, of course. But the New York Times reporter David Scoff says, in some eerie way, it seemed to foresee or predict what the modern media has become. Itzkoff is joining us today to tell the story of Network. Really, it's also the story of the screenwriter Paddy Chayefsky, who poured all of his angst and anguish about the emptiness of modern American life into the film. The book is called Mad as Hell, The Making of Network and the Fateful Vision of the Angriest Man in Movies. David Scuff, I wanted to, what did eventually Petechevsky come to think about television? There's a really great story that you tell from the Carnegie Deli. And Patty's having lunch with a good friend, Howard Gottfried, and Mel Brooks. And it's a great story. Tell the story, if you would.
Sure. So Gottfried is Chayefsky's producing partner who would he would produce Network with. And, you know, Brooks is you know, one of the many, you know, industry pals who sort of stops by at the Carnegie Deli where Chayefsky is holding court usually every day. And Brooks tells him that, you know, they get into this sort of discussion slash argument about, you know, sort of the stupidity of TV and how much how much you know culture can TV really allow? How much does it understand? And you know there was just this live TV broadcast of Death of a Salesman, and you know so maybe that seems to indicate that TV is you know sort of broadening its horizons a little bit. And Brooks says that he's you know he's to illustrate the point he's going to. Get on the phone and make a phone call to an executive that he knows, and he gets on and he pretends to be Bertolt Brecht, who is the author of The Three Penny Opera, and he's looking to sell the rights to that to NBC if they're interested, and he gets through to an assistant, and the assistant gets on with the you know the executive that she works for and says Bertolt Brecht is on the line for you, and the executive says, how can it be Bertolt Brecht? He's dead. And the assistant says to the executive, are you sure he's dead? Because I've got him on the line right now. And the executive says, oh, sorry, that's different. Hold on. So this is all to illustrate how little, you know, how little credit the, you know, people like Chayefsky and Brooks want to give the TV executives and how little they seem to really know about culture and, yeah. and its world.
Because, of course, Brecht was dead.
Yes, he was quite unavailable.
Calls. Yeah. at some point in this story, I think this is 1974. You talk about how Paddy Chayefsky turns up at the headquarters of NBC News. They're in Rockefeller Center, and he tells the president of the news department, Richard Wald, "I'm going to." And mind you, he's pretty disheveled. He's like in a sweatshirt and these beat up boots and these corduroy pants. And he says to the president of NBC News, "I'm going to spend the day with you." What does he have in mind?
Well, you know, at this point, even Chayefsky isn't quite sure what he's going to write. I mean, he had used his, you know, he still had contacts in NBC's entertainment department to kind of, you know, get him these meetings or at least, you know, just to kind of, you know, poke around and investigate. But he wasn't sure what he was going to write. He hadn't, even though he had worked in TV for several years, he didn't really know how the news side of their operations worked. And so he just wants to observe and see, you know, how many people are employed in these places and, you know, just in a given day, you know, what does Walter Cronkite's schedule look like? What does John Chancellor's schedule look like? And how do they spend their day? And, I mean, he learns quite a bit on these visits, I mean, really from the ground up. But it also starts to become clear that, you know, what he's shaping is something that's going to be very satirical and you know, network evolves, you know, from these observations and also what he learns just about how TV and TV news, you know, is put together.
He isn't just interested in national network news. I didn't realize this. He also looked at some local news programs. You mentioned one of them. This local team of reporters who called themselves the Four Horsemen, which sounds a lot, I have to say, it sounds a lot like the movie Anchorman, really.
Doesn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, he literally, I mean, these guys were literally in a TV commercial at the time. They called themselves the Four Horsemen, and they would dress up like, you know, Wild West cowboys and, you know, ride in on horses, almost like they were sort of, you know, clearing up a kind of lawless frontier town. I mean, you could see, you know, Will Ferrell and Steve Carell and Paul Rudd doing much the same in one of their movies. But, you know, he's looking at, you know, there's a very famous 60 Minutes, you know, report that Chayefsky looked at also from this time where they were looking at the local news market in San Francisco where you had, I think, three or four different Local TV broadcasts all competing with each other. And the one that was prevailing was the one that was sort of the most tabloid and the most sensationalistic, and the one doing, news stories about, bloody crimes and dismemberments and fire and exorcisms and all these ridiculous things. But that was the one that was the most successful. So, for Chayefsky, it was sort of easy to extrapolate that, okay, if this is working at the local level, it's only a matter of time before this kind of, graduates up to the national level. And that was going to be sort of one of the instigating incidents of his screenplay, where you would have a kind of young hotshot producer from a local market who then gets promoted to the network level and starts sort of, applying all of his tabloid tricks and trades to save a failing network. And the big switch that he makes along the way is that this character always was going to be male, and then at one point he sort of realizes, well, what if I made it a woman? Mm-hmm. And that's the character that Faye Dunaway ends up playing, Diana Christensen.
Yeah. I want to back up just a bit, because there's this thing where this satire called The Imposters that he writes, a series, wants to write anywhere for television. And it's pretty audacious, because in some ways what he wants to do is make fun of television on television, which sort of dooms the thing, despite the fact that he makes a movie that makes fun of media. But he, and I think that there's a section I wanted to have you read, and it's by this character that he writes, named Eddie Gresham, this, fictional TV executive with the United Broadcasting System. These are all themes, of course, that appear ultimately in Network. And Eddie knows that television is shallow. Eddie Gresham,
right.
Chayefsky's narrative description of Gresham is that Gresham knew that Eugene O'Neill wins the Nobel Prize, but Bonanza wins a 38 share in the ratings. I mean, he kind of knows the way it works. And his impression of television plays out in this section. Do you want to set this up for him? Because I want to read this. It's really interesting.
Sure. So again, this is in 1969. He's writing a pilot for CBS called The Imposters, and it did not get picked up, and so it's sort of unclear how the story would have even continued past the pilot episode. But the premise is that you have this kind of disillusioned TV executive who connects with a kind of down on his luck Borscht Belt comedian, a kind of Mel Brooks type, actually. And the two of them are going to just sort of go from place to place, impersonating people and bringing about social change by pretending to be, high-ranking people that they are not. But the TV executive character is, he's got no illusions about how his business really operates.
Yeah.
You want me to read the monologue?
If you
here?
Would, yeah.
Oh, sure. So, he says, we're not in the business of good drama. We're in the boredom-killing business. That's what my job is. That's what I do all day, think up ways of killing the boredom of 200 million Americans. I concoct game shows and soap operas and schedule professional sports programs. I think up musical entertainments and talk shows for people who've forgotten how to talk to each other. What the hell has happened to us Americans anyway? We seem to have lost whatever identity we ever had. We used to be pioneers, homesteaders, farmers, craftsmen, shopkeepers, robber barons, bohemians, Whigs, Tories, rail splitters, immigrants. Now we're 200 million whiter than white, softer than soft, deodorized, standardized, simonized, plastic and programmed things, totally indistinguishable from each other, any one of us replaceable just by ordering another part from the factory. Some curious integrity has gone out of Americans that made them curiously American. They don't want drama, especially good drama. They just want their boredom killed.
It occurs to me, beyond some of the kind of brands like Simonized and stuff that may not stand up today, this would work as an expression of frustration for today, don't you think?
Oh, sure. I mean, it's certainly a lot. I mean, that's something that he wrote in 69.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of that language, then gets repurposed in Network, 7 years later. But it's still, that could almost be a scene on Mad Men. I mean, it could be a 1960s ad man, complaining about his job in a way that would still be relevant in 2014.
David Scoff is with us. His book is called Mad as Hell, The Making of Network and the Fateful Vision of the Angriest Man in Movies. We need to take another quick break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with David Scoff. We're talking about his book, Mad as Hell, The Making of Network, and the fateful vision of the angriest man in movies. So I wanted to ask you about, so the screenplay, of course, takes shape, and then we get to Sidney Lumet, who's going to direct it. Talk a little bit about Sidney's, his relationship with Paddy Chayefsky, the vision that they talk about. It's a really interesting part of the book.
Yeah, I mean, Lumet had in some ways, I mean, he'd come up in much the same way as Chayefsky, that he also starts off, you know, in the golden age of television, of course, as, you know, primarily as a director and directing lots of live TV, and then also has a kind of early breakthrough or crossover to motion pictures by directing the film version of 12 Angry Men. Mm. And then that sort of puts him on a cinematic trajectory. And, you know, by the 70s, he's made films like Serpico and Dog Day Afternoon, which are all about sort of, you know, the gritty side of New York and, you know, New York in decline. And, you know, so, I mean, certainly he's a highly respected director and one with a very kind of clear directorial vision. And yet, you know, when he comes into a project like Network, you know, he knows going in that if he – his relationship to Chayefsky is, if not a kind of collaboration, it's going to be one where he's even going to be sort of subordinate to Chayefsky. That, yeah. You know, that he's – you know, it's not that he's not going to get to put his stamp on it or do things the way that he, you know, would like to do. But ultimately, this is going to be Chayefsky's movie. And to some extent, he's going to have to take – you know, Chayefsky's input is something that he's going to have to allow for and accept, and he's not always going to get his way on things in the way that a director normally would. And I mean, by most accounts, they had a really, you know, positive, you know, working relationship and didn't step on each other's toes all that much. But it's a very unusual arrangement for, you know, any director to accept. I mean, particularly for Lumet at that point in his career, and it just kind of shows you. I mean, again, the sort of the power that Chayefsky, you know, insisted upon and exercised in his projects.
Well, because as you say, when we think about Network, we think about it as Paddy Chayefsky's film.
Well, that was also by his demand. Right. I mean, if you go back and actually – if you watch the opening credits of the film, you will see it does not say – you know, screenplay by Paddy Chayefsky, or, you know, from a script by Paddy Chayefsky. It, you know, the title Network comes up, and the next credit you see is by Paddy Chayefsky.
Yeah.
And then all the other creative credits follow. I mean, he really wanted – he wanted you to know that it was his authorship first and foremost.
You know, it's hard to imagine anyone but Peter Finch in this role. But you do mention, and it's throughout the book, you know, the idea of – the casting, of course, you know, and Chayefsky had imagined Jimmy Stewart in this role, and Henry Fonda, and Gene Hackman he's thinking about, and Robert Montgomery as well.
I mean, certainly when you make – I mean, I think that's – the reality of when you make a movie is that, you know, you have to be open to a lot of different kinds of actors just because, you know, there's no guarantee you're going to get your first or second or even third choice. So, I mean, they had to be – you know, flexible to that extent, but I don't think the filmmakers ever realized sort of just how far down you know, the list they would have to go to find their Howard Beale. I mean, it's remarkable because, you know, for Finch, I mean, it is, you know, the role of a lifetime. Mm-hmm. It totally alters his career. It's, you know, you couldn't imagine anybody playing it better. And yet, you know what I mean, it's something that the filmmakers come to because they've had so much difficulty casting the role, and because so many other, you know, A-listers, you know, really just don't want to touch the part, that they already can kind of sense that it's going to be very volatile and controversial and maybe even a little bit vulgar and just, you know, not something that they want to be involved with.
Well, we've got to play the scene, Mad as Hell.
Please.
What I love about this, too, is – and maybe set this up for us a bit. I get a sense – I mean, Finch only has a certain amount of energy to deliver this speech. I mean, it was and I wanted you to say something about that. I guess – I don't know if it was exhausting emotionally, or, I mean, what was that? That was – he just really got spent.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's so sort of, you know, physically demanding. It's just a lot of dialogue, and it goes on for a while. I mean, certainly, you know, compared to how we're used to how movies look and sound today with, you know, quick cuts and, you know, lots of exchanges among characters, this is just one person, you know, talking at kind of almost maximum intensity for a while.
Yeah.
And, you know, by the time he films this scene, you know, Finch is very close to 60. And, you know, he's clean at this point in his life, but he had, you know, a long period in his life when he was working as an actor in London where, he, you know, he was a great carouser, as they say, and hanging out with, you know, folks like Peter O'Toole and Errol Flynn and just tearing up the town every night. So to have to do a scene like this is, you know, hugely demanding on him. And, you know, Lumet had him, you know, do the scene all the way through once and, you know, with the camera rolling, and had a second camera ready to go, already loaded with film, so that they could, you know, go right into a second take, you know, with really no delay. And, you know, Finch got about halfway through that second take and then, you know, just stopped himself and told Lumet, you know, I just can't do anymore. I can't go any further. And that was all that Lumet, you know, made him do or asked him to do. That, you know, this iconic scene is comprised of the second half of the first take and the first half of the second take, and that's it. There's only one, you know, full take of Finch performing the speech in its entirety.
I don't have to tell you things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad. It's a depression. Everybody's out of work or scared of losing their job. The dollar buys a nickel's worth. Banks are going bust. Shopkeepers keep a gun under the counter. Punks are running wild in the street, and there's nobody anywhere who seems to know what to do, and there's no end to it. We know the air is unfit to breathe, and our food is unfit to eat. We sit watching our TVs while some local newscaster tells us that today we had 15 homicides and 63 violent crimes, as if that's the way it's supposed to be. We know things are bad, worse than bad. They're crazy. It's like everything everywhere is going crazy, so we don't go out anymore. We sit in the house, and slowly the world we're living in is getting smaller, and all we say is, please, at least leave us alone in our living rooms. Let me have my toaster and my TV and my steel-belted radios, and I won't say anything. Just leave us alone. Well, I'm not going to leave you alone. I want you to get mad. I don't want you to protest. I don't want you to riot. I don't want you to write to your congressman because I wouldn't know what to tell you to write. I don't know what to do about the depression and the inflation and the Russians and the crime in the street. All I know is that first, you've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value. So, I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore! I want you to get up right now. Get up, go to your windows, open them, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore. Things have got to change.
How many stations does this go out?
You've got to get mad.
67. I know it goes to Louisville and Atlanta.
I'm not going to take this anymore. Then we'll figure out what to do about the depression and the inflation and the oil crisis. But first, get up out of your chairs, open the window, stick your head out and yell, and say, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
It does seem exhausting. I mean, if you're performing it,
yeah.
I mean,
to have to be the one to perform that's a lot. And you know, if you can go back and even look at how the scene is edited, there's lots of you know, coverage of,
yeah,
you know, Faye Dunaway sort of, you know, licking her chops as she sees that, you know, this is really getting more and more exciting.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there's really no alternate angles of Finch. It's just this one kind of long, you know, dolly in on him and then that close up and that's it.
So give us a sense of the reaction. How did people react to it? It's one of the things you write about. I mean, you know, you had people like Cronkite who were outraged by the portrayal, thought it oversimplified his life's work, those kinds of things. What was this? How were people reacting to it?
Well, certainly, you know, the news business itself was totally scandalized. I mean, you know, across the board, people were pretty, you know, offended and horrified at how, you know, how the movie had sort of portrayed the business. And, I mean, that did have partly to do with, you know, the fact that Chayefsky had been given this insider's access, and a lot of folks felt like he had kind of, you know, stabbed them in the back, you know, to basically make fun of them. But also because, you know, I think, I mean, it sort of, you know, it just seemed somehow undignified to them that their industry could ever be portrayed this way, that somehow – you know, even though they knew it was, you know, exaggerating to some degree, they felt like, you know, the news business just has its own kind of internal, you know, monitors and its own sense of standards and propriety, that it would never allow itself to go this far, that it just knew how to control itself before things ever really got, you know, this out of hand, which of course is now all kind of, you know, hilarious to think about. But, you know, so I mean, that was pretty uniformly, you know, negative. Even in the critical community, I mean, you had reviewers, you know, like Vincent Canby of the New York Times, who were very wildly positive, really, you know, saw this as, you know, the birth of a totally new and original satirical voice and an important movie. But then you also had critics who were, you know, whose reactions were strongly negative, whether that was, you know, Pauline Kael at The New Yorker, who, you know, was very dismissive of the film, or, you know, someone like Frank Rich, who at the time was a critic for The New York Post and, you know, also thought that the movie was, you know, very, you know, messily made and, you know, had lots, you know, lots of issues with it. But even among the critics, you know, yay or nay, there's this kind of running thread, you know, through all the reviews almost of this kind of consensus that, you know, whether or not we like the film, we all agree that there's, you know, the world that Chayefsky's depicting is preposterous. It's an exaggeration. It's this kind of far-flung thing that's, you know, it's so way out that it could just never happen. Everybody seems to sort of rally around that idea at the very least. And again, that's something that we know. You know, I mean, that did not stand the test of time, that assertion. But all the controversy was very good for the film commercially. You know, it made on a budget of about $4 million, it made about $20 million in its original release and, you know, was nominated for I believe 10 or 11 Oscars and won 4. So it certainly performed, you know, very solidly.
One thing you say in the latter part of the book, you talk to people who work in the broadcast media these days, and it's interesting. You also talk about that for people who dispense the news, you say a lot of them take their direction straight from the playbook of Howard Beale. You know, as I mentioned this in the introduction, emoting and inveighing and instructing the audiences how to feel and even crying on camera. I guess we see a lot of Howard Beales from time to time.
There are quite a few out there, although, you know, by and large, you know, a lot of broadcasters won't necessarily say that they themselves are Howard Beale. They might say that their competitors are the ones who are behaving like Beale. But, you know, you don't have to look very far and turn your dial very far, if people still use TV dials anymore, you know, to see just a range of personalities who all kind of behave this way. I mean, that is, you know, the job of the newscaster is not to be a kind of, you know, dispassionate reciter of facts anymore. It's all about, you know, the whatever emotion and perspective, you know, you bring to the job. That's how they distinguish themselves. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, part of what Chayefsky was warning about.
Well, you spend a good amount of time talking about how things transformed. It wasn't long after Network, 1976. The 80s comes along and something changes significantly, where network news stopped being considered a public service and became a sense of entertainment. And that seemed to be a really important transition.
Yeah. And I mean, again, bear in mind that happens even before, you know, cable TV, you know, really starts to assert itself, that there, you know, there's basically the one thing that the TV, you know, all the people who were furious at network, the one thing that they always insisted was never going to happen is that, you know, news was never going to lose its sort of, you know, its patina of, as you say, public service, that it was never going to have to be, you know, driven by ratings or by commerciality in the way that entertainment programming is. It was never going to have to turn a profit. And if you remember, there's even a line that, you know, Robert Duvall sort of accosts William Holden with in the movie, where he says, you know, I'm sick and tired of your cruddy news division and its 33, you know, its annual $33 million deficit. I mean, that's not a number that Chayefsky plucked out of thin air. I mean, that's really, to run a news division of a network, you had to be committed to losing, you know, tens of millions of dollars a year. And certainly, by, you know, by the 80s, as, you know, networks like CBS start to get bought up by larger corporations, they're looking at the bottom line and they're saying, well, why doesn't, you know, why should news have this sort of special status anymore? Why doesn't it have to be profitable in the same way that our sitcoms and dramas are? And that's really the beginning of the transition. That's when you have these massive bloodlettings at places like CBS, people, you know, a lot of people losing jobs. And, you know, that transition of, you know, now news itself has to, you know, make money. And the way to do it is for, you know, that's when news basically has to become entertainment.
Let me ask you this finally, but less than a minute left. I guess it's impossible to speculate. Do you have any sense at all how Paddy Chayefsky would have – what he would have thought of the modern media universe?
I mean, I have to think he'd be horrified. I think if you introduced him to, you know, even something like Twitter, which is basically, you know, you think about all those voices shouting out their windows, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take this anymore. I mean, what is Twitter but that? It's that same kind of cacophony, but just, you know, confined to, you know, the electronic space as opposed to, you know, the free air. But I think he would see that and be, you know, pretty devastated.
David Scuff. His book is called Mad as Hell, The Making of Network and the Fateful Vision of the Angriest Man in Movies. Joined us this morning from New York. David Scuff, thanks very much.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thank you.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.